those eagles will let you get fairly close to them too, and sets it up for a bad situation for somebody that wants to plink at them.
Officials investigate a string of unusual wildlife killings in Sitka. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 4th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Homer pilot works her way through bureaucratic roadblocks in Haiti.
I've been all day just like stretching my brain, trying to figure out how we're going to do this and what planes we're going to use, and my head's spinning.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The 3 men on trial in Point Hope for wasting caribou meat were found guilty today. Aquila Hank, Chester Koenig, and Roy Miller Jr. were tried in a makeshift courtroom this week in Point Hope's community center. The case dates back to 2008, when state troopers said numerous caribou were left to rot on the tundra when they should have been salvaged. The 8 hunters originally charged with waste maintained the animals had prior shot wounds that were infected, or they had suspicious spots on their organs that led the men to fear the meat may have been contaminated with brucellosis or other diseases. 5 of the men took plea deals and were sentenced to fines and community service. Alaska Dispatch reporter Jill Burke has been in Point Hope covering the trial and joins me now. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Lori.
Jill, what did the judge say to explain the guilty verdicts?
I'll get to that in just a moment. I just want to correct one quick thing. There's been a lot of defendants to keep track of, but we actually have only 4 who took plea deals. The case against a 5th from that first group of hunters was actually dismissed due to lack of evidence. So we have 4 guilty from plea deals and 3 guilty today from the judge's verdict.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that correction.
Sure thing. So basically, the judge said that, first of all, he thanked the defendants and said that he held them in the highest esteem, that he held in regard that they didn't have to take a deal. They spent a lot of time and money fighting these charges for what is a nominal charge, a civil violation that's basically likened to a traffic ticket. And it affects more than their future, he acknowledged. It affects their honor, and he had great respect for them for standing up for that and bringing it to trial. He ultimately found them guilty of failing to salvage 2 caribou, 1 that was shot up and they had claimed could not be salvaged because there was too much damage. He said there was no mention made about the backstrap, so he took that to mean that that probably would have been salvageable, so he denied their arguments on that front. And then on the other one, the defendants mounted a necessity defense saying they feared it had disease. They had no other choice by following their own traditional customs and practices to then leave it out in the tundra and not bring it back to the village, to their homes and their community, where it might potentially infect not only their families, but more people as well. He rejected that and said that the evidence from the state's experts was credible, that the illness they feared was so severe was in fact not severe in the Alaska caribou herd, a bacteria called brucellosis, that it's not fatal here, there are no documented cases, and that even if there is an infected caribou, that if you were to eat the meat would be okay because the disease doesn't reside in the meat. So he rejected all of their defenses and found them guilty on both of those charges, failure to salvage meat.
And when elders testified, what points were they trying to make? What were they trying to get across?
The elders came in the steady stream and said, basically, we have these practices. We have been taught by our fathers and their fathers before them to not bring disease or sick meat into the community, to leave it behind. Now, they also had practices of taking suspect meat and feeding it to the dogs. The prosecutors pointed out hey, don't you guys know that feeding caribou to dogs is illegal? Many of them said no, they had been unaware of that. So there's some definite customs and practices here in place regionally that are in conflict with the state's hunting laws, laws that were in place predominantly for trophy hunters, the community would argue. But the state said, look, that doesn't absolve you from being aware of these laws and following them. And obviously the judge agreed.
Jill, do you think this has the potential to change minds on either side, either how animals are hunted in the region or how the state views subsistence hunting?
Boy, you know, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. The remedy that we've heard spoken to prior to this trial and during the trial itself is to go to the Board of Game and change the state's hunting regulations. There had been proposals last fall and considered at this January statewide meeting to change the definition of edible meat, but that ended up not going anywhere. So it's a little bit unclear if the will of the people will be able to move the large system of government to actually make some, I don't know, finesse changes to the regulations that everybody is required to live under. The testimony that we heard from locals up here was that they would very much like to see the laws change so that customary and traditional practices of subsistence hunting aren't required to, say, for example, have a license to hunt and not required to follow to some of the existing laws that they feel may be in conflict with the way they have always done things. That having been said, the very same people that testified to that said it's not that they want to live in conflict with the state's laws, but they would like to see things be married in a way that are more harmonious and not grinding up against the old ways and the new so much.
And Jill, thank you so much for being with us. Quickly, when will the men be sentenced and what type of sentences can we expect?
Well, that's interesting. They were sentenced expediently today. Immediately after the judge rendered the verdicts, he sentenced them. And his sentence for them was no sentence. He refused to impose any fine, any community service. And that was to underscore the great distinction between the case of these three men and the case of the other hunters, where there were clear animals wasted, bodies that were able to be connected back to that group. And in this case, there was no physical evidence. The troopers didn't have any carcasses that they could connect to this group. All they had were the admission and the honesty of the hunters that ultimately ended up landing them in court. And the judge underscored that, and he wanted it made very, very clear that this group of hunters was not connected to that large-scale massacre and slaughter that hit the headlines back in July of 2008 and then again in March in 2009 when these eight men all stood accused. So he thanked them for their honesty and for sitting through the trial, encouraged them to continue to be leaders in their community. And in fact, state troopers and the prosecutor drifted over to them and they all shook hands. And troopers asked these men if they would help with the community service of the other defendants and help ensure that they're learning proper hunting techniques. So it was a, you know, an awkward trial for both sides, I think, but it appears like this is a resolution people are okay moving forward with at this point.
All right. Thank you so much, Jill, for being with us. Jill Burke is a reporter for Alaska Dispatch. You can find her stories online at alaskadispatch.com. What began with the death of a swan last month in Sitka's Stargavin Valley has turned into a spree of protected bird killings. Federal and state authorities are investigating the shooting of six bald eagles on popular trails around Sitka. One of the dead birds had been recently released by the Alaska Raptor Center. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Like the swan, the six eagles were all killed by gunshot wounds from a small-caliber firearm. Phil Mooney is the area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's been working closely with state and federal law enforcement on the case. Mooney says eagles are starting to congregate around town in anticipation of the spring herring spawn, and they make easy targets.
Sit in pretty obvious places, and because of the proximity of people, a lot of those eagles will let you get fairly close to them, too, and sets it up for a bad situation for somebody that wants to plink at them.
Those obvious places, Mooney mentions, are not particularly off the beaten path, especially where gunfire is concerned. One of the eagles was killed at about the same time as the swan in the Stargavin Estuary. A second eagle was discovered on the Mosquito Cove Trail. and a third on the Indian River Trail. A couple of eagles were killed on small islands adjacent to Sitka's road system, and a sixth was shot downtown in Sitka National Historical Park. Mooney would not elaborate on the investigation except to say that it is active, and the sheer number of incidents and their locations defy logic.
Maybe a kid got a new gun for Christmas. Trying out, but the thing that was interesting is that they're all in very public places.
The swan was protected under the Federal Migratory Species Act. The eagles fall under the Federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act of 1940. Prior to the passage of that law, the Alaska Territory at times paid a bounty on eagles since they were thought to deplete salmon runs. Now, eagles are held in high esteem by residents and visitors alike. The Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka has an international reputation for its success rehabilitating bald eagles. One of the six killed in January had been restored to health 2 years ago by the center. Mooney said he recognized the bird right away.
They called it trap because it was caught in a trap, and they had to amputate a toe, and they were not quite sure how the bird would fair being released back into the wild without one of those toes, but it had done quite well based on their recovery of the carcass.
The carcass of Trap and the other five eagles have been retained by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as evidence. At the conclusion of this case, Mooney says it's likely that the birds will be transferred to the National Eagle Repository in Commerce, Colorado. The repository stores dead bald and golden eagles and distributes their feathers and other parts to tribal groups for ceremonial purposes. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a struggling caribou herd on a remote island.
We're concerned enough about it that even waiting another year, we're thinking might just be the end of that herd.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A Homer pilot who has spent the last 2 weeks helping the organization Agape Flights deliver aid to earthquake victims in Haiti made her first flight into the country on Monday. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
Stephanie Anderson, a pilot for Homer-based Smoky Bay Air, flew a twin otter loaded with enough tents to house 3,000 people from Sebastian, Florida into Port-au-Prince Monday afternoon. The scene she found there was chaotic.
Air traffic control there is just a huge mess. They have more traffic than you can imagine trying to get in there. And they've got, this poor Haitian controller that is not used to dealing with that level of traffic. So it's really hard to get on the radio, and it's really hard to know what other planes are around you. So what we did is we went under the clouds, and then it's basically just us looking for planes. They don't have any radar down there, and you're landing with every kind of aircraft, from single-engine Cessnas to C-5s, C-130s, UN helicopters. If there's even remotely bad weather and you can't do what we did and go visual, it would be even worse.
Anderson and her co-pilot, Rook Nelson, managed to sneak in behind a C-130 and land at the airport, where hundreds, if not thousands, of aid workers and military personnel are living in temporary tent cities. Anderson says a group of Haitian men were eager to offload their supplies and express their gratitude for the help. When it was time to go, three girls, two Americans and an Australian with an American green card, suddenly climbed into the plane, asking for transport to the United States. Anderson and Nelson were inclined to oblige, but recent changes to Haitian immigration rules, says Anderson, have prevented many aid workers from leaving.
And so you've got these volunteers that are in there, and they didn't volunteer for the long haul. They kind of thought they were just going down to Haiti to help out, and then they're going to leave. and they don't have a way to get out. And so what they're doing is they're going over to the general aviation ramp, which or the cargo ramp. They're just asking pilots, hey, could you give me a ride out? We kind of thought, yeah, of course. Yeah, well, let's see your papers. Okay. Then one of the guys at the airport came up and said, you know, they've said, actually, you can't do that. You can't take them off the cargo ramp. You have to process them through the international terminal just like you would any other travelers. If you break those rules, there'll be a $10,000 fine, and they'll put the registration number of an aircraft on a list, so every time you cross the U.S. border, the whole aircraft will get torn apart.
The girls had to get off the plane. The only other option for stranded workers, says Anderson, is to try to make it to the Dominican Republic and catch a commercial flight. The waiting list for such flights, however, is 3 weeks long. Bureaucracy, says Anderson, is beginning to seriously impede efforts to provide aid.
Just last night at 9 o'clock, I got a call that there's a group of orphans that needs to get out of Cape Haitian. So we have about 15 kids that are ready to go that have parents waiting in the United States. And we figure if we can get them out before the rules change, we can get 15 kids that were orphaned by the earthquake into that orphanage. So I got a call at 9 o'clock last night that this is the case. We need to get 15 kids out. And I've been all day just, like, stretching my brain, trying to figure out how we're going to do this and what planes we're going to use. And my head's spinning.
Anderson is committed to spending at least one more week with Agape Flights, but she's thinking about staying longer. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selvig.
The caribou population on Unimak Island has dropped to dangerously low levels, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is developing a plan to help restore it. Recent surveys found only 300 caribou on the island in the far eastern Aleutians, and only 15 of them were bulls. In 2009, only 7 calves survived into recruitment, mostly because of predation by wolves. ADFNG Assistant Commissioner Corey Rossi says the decline might be part of the caribou's natural population cycle. However, the numbers are so low that the department is worried that the population may not be able to rebound.
So what we've got is a situation where we have almost no calf recruitment because the what few calves that are being produced are being eaten up by wolves. But equally important is the fact that for whatever reason, the way the demographic ended up in this particular situation is we have so few bulls that we don't think we're getting all the cows bred anyway.
Rossi says having more cows than bulls is normal in caribou populations, but this ratio is dangerously off. ADFNG is considering a two-part solution, introducing more bulls to the population and culling a select number of wolves that hunt on the calving grounds.
It wouldn't be an effort to just go out and randomly find a wolf and remove it just for the sake of saying, hey, we got one. It would be a very strategic, very surgical type operation.
The plan also includes bringing 15 bulls to the island from the Southern Alaska Peninsula herd.
Sometimes caribou and other wildlife as well, when you move them, they try to get home. And so we don't really know whether or not those bulls might not just turn around and swim back home. You know, that's something that remains to be seen.
The population rebuilding strategy is still in the planning stages and will be discussed at the March Board of Game meeting in Fairbanks. Rossi says they want to act by this summer.
We're concerned enough about it that even waiting another year, we're thinking might just be the end of that herd.
Currently, no subsistence hunting of caribou is allowed on the island. The caribou, wolves, and other large mammals originally came to the island by swimming through the short pass between Unimak and the mainland.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The The biggest economic hurdle in rural Alaska is high energy costs. That was the message from about 50 elected officials who took part in Tuesday's Alaska Conference of Mayors. The conference was part of the Alaska Municipal League's annual legislative meeting happening this week in Juneau. One of AML's priorities for this session is a statewide energy plan for local communities. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Martha Whiting is mayor of the Northwest Arctic Borough, which has a population of about 7,400 and covers an area roughly the size of Indiana. The regional hub is Kotzebue, which has no roads connecting it to the other 10 communities in the borough or the outside world. So it's not surprising when Whiting says the people there face many challenges.
The high cost of energy, the high cost of living, the high cost of transportation to bring goods and services into the region.
To some extent, subsistence hunting and fishing helps Northwest Arctic Borough residents make up for what they can't buy in stores. But when it comes to energy, Whiting says the people of the region continue to struggle. They pay the highest average heating fuel prices in the state, according to a report released this week by the Department of Commerce.
We're feeling like we're living in third world conditions in a very resource-rich state, especially in a very resource-rich area.
But Whiting says they're not just standing idly by. The borough promotes conservation, and she says they're looking to other parts of the state for inspiration.
We're looking at solar panels for our schools. We're looking at solar panels for our city buildings. We're looking at converting our street lights into LED lights. We're looking at wind turbines to produce energy. And we're looking at a lot of opportunities here with hydropower, people that geothermal, what works in one area will help support what we want to do.
Thousands of miles to the south in Angoon, Mayor Albert Howard says electricity costs are some of the highest not only in southeast, but the entire state.
Well, right now, I believe it's around, I hear it's about 42 cents a kilowatt, and they're asking for a 10% rate increase on top of that. And last year, we paid 62 cents a kilowatt all winter long, so that was pretty devastating.
Angoon is located on Admiralty Island, about 60 miles southwest of Juneau. In November, the city was awarded a preliminary permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for a hydropower project at Ruth Lake, a permit that Wrangell and Petersburg had sought as well. That caused the larger communities some angst, but Howard says he's hoping they can work together to move the project forward soon.
It's kind of the cost of energy is holding the community back from, creating jobs, which creates hope. You always want to have hope. If somebody gives up, bad things happen.
Members of the State Senate Energy and Resources Committee spent much of last summer holding hearings around Alaska to gather input on a statewide energy plan. Lawmakers are still in the process of crafting the plan, which is expected to include traditional and alternative means of producing energy. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Juneau may again bid to host the Arctic Winter Games. Mayor Bruce Botello has called for an organizational meeting tonight with an eye on a bid for 2014. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander looks at what's been learned since Juneau's previous bid for the Games.
The capital city lost its bid to Kenai for the 2006 Games, but organizers say they're smarter now.
We would provide marine access, so that would take that factor off the table.
Jim Powell led the city's bid in the winter of 2003. The Arctic Winter Games International Committee was to fly into Juneau on a foggy Saturday in January. The plane overheaded and landed in Sitka. Committee members didn't get to Juneau until Sunday.
I don't think you'd get any argument from anyone that hurt our bid.
Meanwhile, Juneau had no snow, not even at Eagle Crest Ski Area, which didn't open that winter until February. But that was 3 years before the March 2006 Games that Juneau, Fairbanks, and Kenai were competing to host.
Kenai had poor snow, too. So we weren't the only ones that were hit with poor weather. Really, the weather is not a factor.
Powell is vice president of the Arctic Winter Games Team Alaska Board. He's also attended five Arctic Games and even worked for the International Olympic Committee in the 1980 Winter Olympics at Lake Placid, New York. He's convinced Juneau can successfully bid for the 2014 or 16 Arctic Winter Games.
We've always had snow at the time when the games are held in March at elevation, where the outside sports are and most of the sports are held inside. We're in a much better position to bid because we have more facilities. We have a field house, we have another school, and we're smarter. We've learned some things from the first bid. we've learned that the biggest obstacle is access.
Athletes from Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Russia participate in the Arctic Games. Powell would have them fly to Whitehorse, where they'd be driven to Skagway to board an Alaska State ferry for Juneau. Of course, they could fly here, but he would promote the ferry system as the safest bet. Mayor Bruce Botello says it's premature to make that decision, but transportation is on the list of priorities if the capital city bids on the Games. Hosting them has been one of Botello's long-term goals as mayor.
Having the event itself and having people from around the Arctic nations become exposed to Juneau as Alaska's capital city is the real selling point for us, and it's a chance for us to get to know folks from around the north as well.
Powell kept all the documents from Juneau's 2006 bid, which took months for the steering committee to put together. Tonight's meeting is to gauge interest and Juneau's ability to host well over 2,000 athletes, coaches, and others who participate in the contests. Then there are the estimated 2,500 volunteers necessary to put on the games. Mayor Botello says demonstrating Juneau's readiness to the International Committee will take a lot of lead time.
I think that Juneau offers a compactness. It has wonderful facilities. It is, I think, well known for its hospitality. I think we have the capacity to offer both a true Alaskan experience and a sense of being a small town with all the advantages of a larger city.
Outdoor Arctic Winter Games include alpine and Nordic skiing, snowshoeing, and dog mushing, among other sports, while the list of indoor games is longer, ranging from badminton to wrestling. It's the native cultural competitions, such as the 1 and 2 foot high kick, the knuckle hop, and the Diné contest that distinguish these games from other athletic events. The International Committee will choose the host city 3.5 years in advance. The 2010 Arctic Winter Games are being held in Grand Prairie, Alberta, March 6 to 13. Whitehorse is the 2012 host, while Greenland is the stated host for 2014, Powell says that could change. Alaska is definitely in the rotation for host of the 2016 Games. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Rosemarie Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846. Press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.